isn't just an interesting word, and while we don't have to understand the word in its entirety to understand God's promise, the more that we look, the more interesting I think it is. So when God said that he was going to put us under his kanaf, did he mean under his wings, under the extremity of his garments, or in his corner? Either way, it's his reliable and dependable nature is the large shield to keep you cool and collected, and is steadfast and consistent and firm, and assured reliability is your valuable defender. Pause now and reflect on this. So as I began to think of it, I said, all right, I'm going to look up every time that kanaf is used. And it is used as a bird's wing, as the extremity of a garment, or in a special corner. Kanaf is used to describe the appendage of a bird used to facilitate flight and speaks of a wing. There's a similar word in the Akkadian language, the Aramaic language, and the Ugarit language, which denote both speed and protection. In Hebrew, nouns are defined by their verbal and actionable roots. With this in mind, the verbal root of kanaf, scribed yikanaf, is used only once. In Yeshayah, Isaiah 30:20, it reads, those who gave the bread of adversity and the water, or Yahweh gave the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. And to those, they were removed and put into a corner, assembled there and thrust aside, so that they shall not be his teachers. So this was a special corner that Yahweh isolated individuals who working against him, who were working adversarially against him. And so that would have to be in a special corner. This was done so that your eyes shall see your teachers. This is somewhat reminiscent of one saying, I'm in your corner, while a rival would be found in the corner of another. In Malachi 3:20, a prophecy regarding Yosha is foretold as the greater light of creation's fourth day, having the sun of righteousness rising with healing in his kanaf. Now, does that mean in his wings, corner, or hem of his garment? Now, it's typically translated wings, but its fulfillment was the hem of his garment. Remember when he was walking and a woman reached out and touched the hem of his robe, and by touching the hem of his garment, she was healed. Yeah. So the fulfillment wasn't in him having wings, because he didn't have wings. The fulfillment was the hem of his garment. Now, I'd rather be under the hem of Yahweh's garment, because that's a garment of light. It's comprised of the Torah and the set-apart spirit, than I would to be under wings. But I'm happy to be under Yahweh's wings. He promised that, and he promised and protected by his winged beings. But why would he say wings twice? So I think hem of the garment is the natural conclusion. Now, since this is, I think it's interesting anyway, let's pause a moment longer and examine some of the additional thought-provoking insights into the potential nature of kanaf. Here in Yeshayah 6:1-3, it is the wing. Is it the wing or the extremity of a special garment, or is it a blend of both? An apparatus and apparel which enables upward mobility and the soaring freedom of flight. This is how it reads. He says, I saw my upright one dwelling upon his throne, raised up and lifted up, the hem of the train of his robe filled with filled the prevailing sanctuary. Seraphim were standing from above to approach him, bleached white, or it could be six, wings or borders of the garments. This is kanaf, for each one. With two, they concealed their mouth, their face, their appearance, or presence. With two, they covered their feet. And with two, they flew. So then they called out an invitation to each other. Most set apart. Yahweh, of the conscripts who served with the signed roles, is what fills the totality of the land with his glory, his splendor, and his power, as well as his presence. So here the kanaf is Yahweh's garment, and it is directly associated with the the Malach, the seraphim in this case, the spiritual messengers and envoys of Yahweh. It's directly associated with Yahweh's glory, his nature, his very presence in heaven. And it's beautiful and white. So, an interesting thought. So, while this was
reaching, also, you can consider the the Torah and the garment of light. It is a shelter in a dark world.
Yeah, it is.
You can come out of a dark place, and it's a shelter.
You want to pierce the darkness? Read the Torah,
and everything becomes more clear.
Right. You want to survive the darkness? Rely on the Torah. It says, you should not, this is now returning to Psalm 91, we're in the fifth verse. You should not ever be in awe of or afraid, neither fearing nor revering any aspect of terrorism, or dread this darkness because of a projectile shot flying by day. All right, so this... I know I looked at this as at the time, as and I still do. I mean, this psalm is very personal to me. That doesn't mean that it's not also personal to Kirk and to Jason and to Scott. I think that the Torah, prophets, and psalms were written to be personal to all of us. They apply directly to each and every one of us individually, as well as collectively. So I'm not being presumptuous when I said this was written for me. And as I read it written for me at the time, it says, don't be afraid of the fact that Muslims will threaten to shoot you. Don't be afraid that Muslims will threaten to terrorize you. You should never be in awe nor afraid. Fearing or revering. And don't respect the religion either, just because it's big and powerful and that some of its proponents have lots of money. Don't respect any aspect of its terrorism or the dread this darkness because of a projectile flying by day. Never once, Doc. Never. I think I'm the only person who ever wrote to expose and condemn Islam this vociferously, this directly. Systematically, who did so under their own name. Did all those radio shows under my own name.
You're the only one that's not hiding out.
And not hiding out at all. Have no protection other than Yahweh. It's more than enough. So that was personal. So, you know, Muslims commit 99% of the world's terrorist acts. Their Quran is a product of a depraved man, a rapist, a pedophile, a mass-murdering terrorist who deliberately twisted Talmud readings to distort them to promote his deadly religion. And yet I took him on and lived to tell the tale. This says, I'm going to repeat the opening line because all of this follows from it. You know, our minds no longer in long sentences can remember the opening clause. So I'm going to repeat the opening clause. You should never be in awe of or afraid, neither fearing nor revering the contagious plague, the infectious pestilence, that fatal pandemic that ravages and robs, ransacking and raiding at midday, nor the pestilence, the epidemic of sickening words prompted by the thorn that travels about without light.
Sure, that's not the thorn in Paul's side reference?
I view that as the case. I think the thorn because there's no thorn associated. Well, there are some thorns associated with Muhammad and the Quran. The Quran says that those who don't surrender and submit to Allah will be forced to eat thorn bushes. And they'll have molten pitch pour down their throats. Allah will pour boiling water on them to boil off their skin and then give them a new skin so he can do it again. And just watch him scream. Yeah, Allah is such a loving God.
What a fella.
Yeah, he's a really good guy. So it says, don't be afraid of them. Yes. And when it talks about robbing and ransacking and raiding, you know, the first official act in the Islamic era, Muhammad finally flees Mecca in shame after becoming a laughingstock from the satanic verses, which are true. Muhammad acknowledged the Kaaba's goddesses enrich himself and to empower himself with the Meccans, and then he was laughed out of town. And then he claimed that he flew on a wild ass from Mecca to Jerusalem and was in the temple, which, of course, had been destroyed 600 years earlier, but he was too stupid to know that. And, of course, he then says with the wild ass, he jumped from the temple, which was non-existent, up to heaven. But on the way to Allah's heaven, he had to go through hell, where he saw women, where the vast population of hell, and they were hanging by their breasts from meat hooks, and they were hanging there because they weren't grateful to their husbands. And so he this wild Barak ride where he just like Paul, you know, Paul says, you know, I can't tell you if I did it in body or in spirit, but I can't tell you how many heavens, I can't tell if it really happened, or I can't even tell you what occurred there. The Quranic and Hadith accounts of Muhammad's trip to heaven read just like Paul's in 2 Corinthians. But so here you've got this contagious plague that is being inspired by, and the point I was getting to, by those who are ravaging, robbing, ransacking, and raiding. As Muhammad flees Mecca, the first thing that he does in Yathrib is he raids a Meccan caravan. With a bunch of armed hoodlums, he commits an act of armed robbery. And the Quran in the 8th Surah admits that he went there strictly for the loot. He needed the money, and he thought that rather than earn it, he was going to steal it. And the Quran is clear. He went there for the loot, and it's the 8th Surah begins, stealing is lawful and good. And so Islam was conceived as a criminal enterprise. And once you realize that the first act of Islam in the Islamic era was armed robbery, where Muhammad admits that he did it solely because he wanted to steal what belonged to others, and that he ransacked the caravan and murdered the businessmen, and then butchered their bodies and then gloated over them. Just because that is the nature of this beast, and you know that is something most people would fear. Don't fear it. But he has described Islam.
Also, I think. I don't have my computer in front of me, unfortunately, but I don't know if it's which part of the Torah it's in, but I think Yah actually instructs Israel not to fear false prophets.
Oh, of course. Yeah, one of the things that's in the Torah is that when God lists abominations, there's not a lot of abominations, but one of the abominations is to God is fraud in business, stealing from others, robbing from others. God's very clear. You do not defraud others. Don't steal. In fact, it's one of the 10 statements that he etched in stone. Now, if you want to bring Paul into this, well, I was reading this as Yah's affirmation that I would survive the criticism of Islam and that we'd work together. But if you look at Pauline Christianity, Paul writes that he robbed certain of his churches. He literally uses the term rob. I robbed them.
Well, he's under grace, so you know.
Yeah, he is under grace, all right. And guess where they are. So the thorn here, I think, is that the robbing, ransacking, and raiding is primarily Islam. The pestilence of the sickening words prompted by the thorn, well, that's Paul's poison pen, where he says that the thorn in his side was a messenger from Satan.
Yeah.
You know what I found for De Beer as well?
What's that?
Well, you know, obviously it's epidemic and plague, and then there was a word in one of the translations said a moraine, and I didn't know what a moraine was, so I looked it up. It's a foot and mouth disease.
So, you know, that could be true of really any religion. You know, Pauline Christianity, he's constantly got his foot in his mouth. That's the thing that's interesting about Yahweh, is that he walks the walk and talks the talk. What he said he is going to do and what he says we should do is what he does. When he says you should walk the walk of the Moed Mikre, that's where the walk that he walked. When he walked his children out of Egypt, that's the path they followed. When he arrived in year 4000 Yah, 33 years before year 4000 Yah, he specifically walked the walk of the Mikre. He says what he's going to do, and he does what he says. But you look at the Pauline epistles, and Muhammad, he was always an exception to his own rules.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, you look at Muhammad, he had a whole harem of little girls that were sex slaves and Jews that were rape victims. He had this whole harem. And so when he... spoke to Allah about how many wives someone could have, limited to four. Except for you, Muhammad, you could have as many as you want.
Mm-hmm.
Always an exception to his own rule.
Yeah. Still, I don't know about... as far as Paul goes, I mean, it's a bigger fish to fry.
Yeah,
he is the biggest of all fishes to fry.
He is the biggest fish to fry. I mean, that's the reason why I went through the numbers on Christianity, is that there is no religion in human history that even approaches the number of souls condemned.
He's the greatest killer.
Yeah, so he's the greatest killer of souls in all of human history. By stunning margins. You know, with Jews, at any one time, there may be 15 to 20 million Jews on the planet. Well, there's 2.3 billion Christians.
Yeah. And just so, you know, on the theme, and it's a rather big theme in the last days about the remnant of Israel returning to the land, returning to the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Not just of the tribe of Judah, mm-hmm. but the rest of Israel, right? I think, you know, the majority of them would be coming out of a Christian heritage.
Yeah, certainly Christian countries.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting. I'm out right now translating the first chapter of Yeshayah, and he's speaking of the northern kingdom burning. And it being ravaged by the Assyrian invaders. And he said that Yahweh specifically says that had he not left a remnant, then you would be like Sodom and Gomorrah. And so he is the remnant. So he, you know, there really is a remnant of the 10 tribes that were destroyed and hauled away into captivity. In Assyria, there is a remnant that Yahweh maintained of those 10 tribes, in addition to, of course, Yehuda. I don't know if he has much to say for Benjamin, but I guess there will be a remnant even of Benjamin. So then this says, 1,000 may fall, prostrating themselves, possibly even die, being cast down. Away from your proximity. Many thousands more as a result of your right hand. But this will not strike you.
Wow.
So here you have a warning that a lot of people are going to fall. But they're not going to fall immediately in my proximity. Now you look at just the most recent uprising of fundamentalist Islam in Iraq and Syria. 300,000-400,000 have died. But now I'm doing this program today. Tomorrow I'll be back in Virginia Dam in Ohio. In this environment, I am surrounded by Muslims. You know, there is a huge Islamic center. not far from my house. I can't go anywhere without seeing women playing a Muslim dress-up. Two doors down is a Muslim family. Muslims lived right across the street. They just moved out.
So, this son was really saying, like, you know, the four of us here.
Yeah, they're going to fall.
Being more observant, we have nothing to worry about. And
they're going to going to be cast down. They're going to prostrate themselves. And many are going to die. And then it says, and many more, many thousands more as a result of your right hand. Right hand is how I am prepared. Prophet of Doom. And, it's the evidence that is going to be held against Muslims. But it says, none of this will strike you. I've never had a Muslim hit me. I've had thousands, maybe tens of thousands by now, I don't read their emails anymore, threatened to kill me, threatened to behead me, yet none has touched me. That's the promise.
So he's made good on Psalm 91.
Boy, perfectly. And against extraordinary odds. You know, I don't think that God very often micromanages. I don't think he intervenes in human affairs. I think he is pretty much hands-off and pretty much free will, and I don't think he even knows or gives a hoot about the vast preponderance of people. But if you're going to do something that he wants done, and you're willing to rely on him to get it done, he's going to see to it that you're able to do what he wants.
Well, sign me up. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's the bottom line here. If you he is the Father, and as a Father, there are things that he wants to send his sons and daughters out to do. And if you're willing to do those things in accordance with his way, now his way means there's a lot of things you can't do. You know how many partners I had with the Prophet of Doom? I was offered thousands of partnerships.
Oh, okay, all right.
None, not one.
Okay.
You know, one of the things you learn is you never, ever, ever fight fire with fire. You never form an alliance with evil to fight evil.
You're talking about Christian.
The enemy of my enemy is not my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to do it God's way, you do it God's way. You don't ever sell out. You know, for example, I could have done television shows so long as I had been willing to soften the appeal. But no. If you're going to do it, you do it his way. And if you do it his way, he'll protect you. But, if you do it to try to make money, it's not going to happen. If you do it to try to achieve fame, you're a non-starter. So if you do it his way, he will protect you.
This whole psalm is about protection for those who go out and do this, right?
Yeah, actually, no, it's about, I would say half of it is about protection. Well, the other half of it is about empowerment. Remember I had one really tiny request, which is you're the publicist. You know, it's your message. You know who you want to have hear it. I don't want to be in the publicity business because that's my strength. I never want to be comfortable doing what I know how to do. So you got that. That's the minor one. The major one was protection and empowerment, that we would do this together. Mutual support. That there would be no aspect of this where we were not working together because I knew I wasn't qualified. And I thought working together would be fun. So here's, for example, here's one on working together. He says, you will merely observe and study the consequences and the suffering of the guilty and the wicked. And that's really all I did. I merely observed and I studied. You will only look at and evaluate. You will exclusively gaze upon and consider. You'll think about and ponder the proper response with your eyes, the consequence and the suffering of the guilty and wicked. And that's all I did. I never participated in their suffering. I never joined in the wickedness. I was never a victim of their suffering or their wickedness. I simply looked at what Muhammad said and did with my eyes. And what Muslims following his example are doing with my eyes. So I simply observed it and studied it with my eyes. I was never victimized by it. That's a really a powerful statement.
So that's all I ask you to do to begin with.
Right. Are you? But you know, that's the same thing. It's the exact same thing as the Torah. It's just with your eyes, study this material and follow through with the proper response.
Yeah. It's your perspective, right?
Right. That's correct. And you know, I'm going to tell you that I don't think I could have written Questioning Paul had I not written Prophet of Doom first.
Probably not.
The ploy that Satan uses to beguile and the kind of people and the strategies that he deploys are so evident in the Quran and the Hadith with Muhammad. They're just it's so obvious what's going on that it makes it possible for you to recognize these in Paul, where he is considerably more subtle and clever. Paul is, I think Paul is an idiot. He said he was insane, and he's right. He was an idiot. And he was a very poor communicator. But nonetheless, he was vastly smarter and more clever than Muhammad. And so it's easy to see in Muhammad. Okay, so
he had the Torah training, and he could actually read and write, so he could put together a best package.
Yeah, that's right. One could read and write in several languages, and the other couldn't read or write in any language.
Yeah.
Well, as a matter of fact, the Quran that was handed down in perfect Arabic, which we now know to be Hebrew, couldn't be written down in Arabic because written Arabic didn't even exist at the time that the Quran was allegedly revealed.
You know.
And by the way, it's why the Quran is called Quran, because in the 96th surah, which you would think would be the end of the book, but it's actually the first revelation, Muhammad was asked to Quran. And he says, but I'm illiterate. I cannot Quran. I can't read. So the word is read and recite, kara. And so it was, okay, maybe I can recite because I sure as hell can't read. And that's how that all came to be. So he says, because you, Yahweh, have invoked certainty, appointing and placing by invitation, making available the sheltered sanctuary of the Almighty. Your place to dwell together.
Mikra.
Right back, yeah. It's not only the Mikra, but it's we can know for certain that God has provided his invitations. If we respond, now, by the time when I was asked to do this, I had no idea what the Mikra was. No idea.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what Yahweh's name was. I didn't know him. But, you know, Abraham didn't know him either when they first talked. And he says, I want you to walk out of Babylon and we're going to walk together to the promised land. He didn't know him either. Moshe sure as heck didn't know him when they met around the burning top of the mountain. As a matter of fact, Moshe said, okay, let's say I do this. And by the way, I don't want to do it. But let's say I do this. Who are you?
Tell him you are.
Yeah. Who am I supposed to tell him you are? And you know, he was too embarrassed to say, hey, listen, who are you? I don't even know who you are.
You got a card?
Yeah, you got a card? But this is Kara Sim. He says, because you, Yahweh, have invoked certainty, appointing and placing by invitation, by making available, you have called out and cited as the authority the following action in support of your arguments and propositions to convince and to make the listener feel certain. Putting into effect and placing before us an invitation and summons to the creation and establishment of the sheltered sanctuary. And this is the sheltered sanctuary of the Almighty. God has made a home for us. He has invited us to that home. He has issued invitations. He has called us out of this world. He has established times to meet. I happen to be celebrating unyeasted bread as we speak, and celebrated Pesach earlier in the week. God has an invitation. He wants to meet with us.